At an industry conference in the U.S. earlier this year, the publisher of New York Media, Larry Bernstein, told an audience that his company is careful to focus on reaching an audience in whatever way they want to be reached. Now, you don't need to be an expert to know that forcing your customers in a direction they don't want to go is the best way to introduce them to the competition. So how have attitudes among print consumers evolved over the last few months? We're running the numbers today on The Stack. On today's show, consumer confidence is a delicate thing, but how does it affect the world of print media?
If you deliver something for free, the volume can be amazing. You just put up with the cost of it. But we've seen huge successes when you've had a publication going free.
From fears of a Brexit hangover to the changing relationship between ad agencies and publishers, we're doing the math today on The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tyler Brulé. My guest today is a man whose bank book is always in very fine order. One would hope so, given, of course, the company that he's working for. Alex Wish is an industry analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. Of course, many listeners to Monocle 24 will know that we have a lot of your colleagues coming around the microphone in your various bureaus, also the far side of London from time to time as well. Alex, welcome. And it's sort of already sort of feeling like we're shifting gears into autumn. The thick books are out on newsstand. We can see, of course, the new season in television. There seems to be this general sort of revival. One thing you want to talk about is Brexit, just before we went on air, and some interesting findings, because, of course, everyone was braced. I think we've also been in a bit of a suspended animation all summer, depending on how you look at it. We saw it as not great news, but we've sort of lived for the last 2 months. And now it's reckoning. September's here. We're back to work. What has Bloomberg found, or what have you found in particular?
Well, what's interesting is that the second quarter results were up to the 30th of June. So in the numbers reported by the major companies in the UK, we didn't see that as a huge impact. So what we've seen from there is actually people like ourselves taking a second look at the numbers that for the second half of the year. It's us and it's also forecasters, Zenith Optimedia, Group M, Magna Global, all taking a look at the advertising outlook for the UK in the second half, and they are applying some caution. That means the forecasts are coming down as we speak, and the outlook for the second half of the year and 2017 looks a lot weaker across media platforms in the UK.
Mm. I mean, is anyone surprised by that, though? Because, of course, if we took a look at the top end of the market, speaking very much, of course, about premium brands, the luxury sector, I guess one would have to assume that, is someone going to go out and buy maybe that second coat this autumn? If they have a handbag, do they need a second and a third handbag in 2016? And is that a big part of it? I guess if we're looking at companies which are investing, which are talking to the media agencies to say, look at spend in print, in television, let's dial things back slightly.
It's related to the economy. And I think what happens in economic deceleration, our forecast at Bloomberg are that we're not going to have a recession in the UK, but we're going to have very low growth. What that means for advertising is a switch in the strategy that most marketeers will bring about. In these environments, what usually works is promotion. So switching money out of advertising and into promotion. So rather than having a nice advertising campaign where you show your new products, you sell the same products and you do 2-for-1 and you market that.
Right. So you probably expect as well that we'll probably see a step then throughout the season, whether we're going to see brands going on sale a little bit earlier, but a lot more incentivization geared, probably with an acceleration than would be different than what we'd see in a better season.
We're likely to see promotion rather than advertising.
Do you think there's markets then that benefit from this? So someone says, let's say if a company's headquarters is in Hamburg, or if someone's head office is in New York, they think, we're going to be very cautious about the UK and maybe a little bit of Europe, but this is better news for Southeast Asia, or this comes good for the US in general, do you think?
Well, for us, the main silver lining analyzing the media landscape from the Brexit is actually the fall in the pound. So all the companies that generate dollar revenues but the cost base are in the UK, they benefit. We have a huge advertising, global advertising company like WPP based in the UK reporting in sterling, but most of the revenues are in dollars or euros or other currencies from the emerging markets. That means that actually they do benefit from Brexit in the sense that the more the pound falls, the more they look amazing compared to rivals like Omnicom in the US.
And it has been interesting as well, looking at, and I would even say talking to people who are in the hotel sector just over the last week, being in London. Okay, it was tail end of summer. Restaurants incredibly busy, and certainly I had to have noticed probably a lot of companies inviting regional managers in, et cetera, because what a great time to host people. You know, normally quite expensive to travel. How do you put up five executives in London, et cetera? This is actually, in a very curious way, at least worked well for one side of the premium part of the industry.
For sure. And then taking that into what means financially, we're looking at for the third quarter results that the pound on average will provide an 8% to 9% boost to earnings for those companies that generate dollar earnings.
A little bit later in the program, Alex, we're going to be coming to some of the favorite titles that you brought in, and we'll be talking about that. But of course, it hasn't been all fun all summer. And anyone who has a Bloomberg terminal on their desk knows that, of course, you are delivering stories at a breakneck speed. From Bloomberg Intelligence's point of view on the media side, what else have you been looking at?
Well, one of the things that we're looking at is the outlook for the advertising agencies. There was a huge, I wouldn't say a scandal, but a huge issue happening in the US where the Association of National Advertisers found that agencies were not very open about rebates that they were getting from the media owners and passing it on to their clients. And that's something that we explored. That definitely was a blow for the industry in terms of showing and highlighting something that we all knew was happening, but we wouldn't dare showing it in a report.
Right.
And that was an eye-opening experience for many people in this industry, so that the agency went as far as naming and shaming. And I think that the what it meant for us is we have to take a second look at what it means, the business model of the agencies. They are buying advertising space on behalf of clients, and they are getting good discounts from the media owners because of the bulk. Also, with the advent of programmatic advertising, there's a possibility for them to make more margin on their sales. And the issue is, what is the sustainable business model for the advertising agencies globally? And that's what we're looking at now.
Let me just rephrase that for our listeners who are not in the trenches of selling pages every day. So what you're saying is that there is a big agency, as we all know, who might be representing car companies, dog food sellers, luxury goods companies. I, as a publisher, in Monocle's perspective, I have to go, and oftentimes I can talk to clients direct. Sometimes I'm talking to an agency. We have a big gritty discussion. Someone wants to buy six pages. Maybe we offer them eight and they get a discount, which, of course, that negotiation happens with the agency. And so what you're saying is the agencies have been actually keeping the discount that I offered. It was not being passed on back to the brand.
Exactly. Now, the brand is getting something out of it, because basically the agencies are telling the brand, I can give you a huge discount, and I can also reduce my fees. So the question that I'm asking, and that the industry is asking itself as well, is if the rebates are already part of me making money in the industry. I get the money from somewhere. I either charge the client, the brand. It could be Nestle that I'm charging. It could be Unilever or Ford. So I'm getting the money from the client. And by getting those rebates, I'm able to charge the brand less. But the brand is being charged nevertheless. The chart is hidden somewhere. So the question is, we should be more open about it. And that's what the organization in the US has said. And at the same time, the industry should have the debate, what is the right fee for the agency in actually brokering a deal for the content owner?
Do you think there's a problem? I don't want to jump as far as saying romance, but you know, once upon a time, we had very good media buyers who had a good nose. A publisher would come in or a broadcaster and they would say, I've got this amazing idea for a program. We think it is going to deliver this in ratings, in sales. Of course, it hasn't launched, so it couldn't be backed up. But have we sort of, and of course, you know, we saw, you know, time and time again, major brands which were behind the launch of fantastic titles, great TV programs because they chose to take a punt. Now, we're talking a lot about data. Do you think that somehow, I guess, erases the creativity, that things almost have to be 100% sure bet today?
I think the companies are less willing to take risks, that's for sure, because there's an overemphasis on what we can measure. And sometimes to take risks, you can't measure that up front. You have to take the risk, take a gamble, and go for it with a huge campaign. So what companies do now is they expect to see almost instant performance of their advertising strategies, and that's not always available or possible. At the other end, what I see is happening, and I see an area of hope there, is the increasing merger of what it is advertising and what it is original content generation independently. So you have the huge rise in advertorials, or in our lingo, the native advertising. So that's a huge area of that I see. It's evolving. It's becoming more professional. In the old days, it would be this page has been sponsored by. And I think it's evolving to an interesting article, an interesting bit of content that the reader in the context would like to read and engage with that, knowingly that it's actually been sponsored by a company. And I think the way that's evolving, that is much more creative in the way that that is evolving than many of the things that I see in the digital world or in programmatic.
And just before we go away for a short break, because we want to talk a little bit about some fortunes, good and bad, in publishing after the break. But before that, is that also a threat to traditional advertising agencies, in part to media agencies as well, when we see this rise of advertorials and native advertising? Because oftentimes, the agency is completely cut out of it because it is the brand. It might be the New York Times, and we've seen the New York Times investing very heavily in setting up a big native team. We can look through Bloomberg Businessweek, and we can see, of course, advertorial concepts delivered for governments or big multinationals in a way that's going to speak to the Bloomberg Businessweek reader. And the traditional agencies don't get involved. Oftentimes, it is just a discussion between your ad salesperson and someone on the marketing team at the brand. Does that pose perhaps a much bigger threat to the traditional world of agencies than we thought maybe 3 or 4 years ago?
The agencies have always been under threat, and I see an even bigger threat than the native advertising in the form of the rise of search advertising. Because basically, if all you're doing in order to enhance sales is going to Google and get search, you know, why would you need an agency? Now, the answer to that, to the advertorial, to the native advertising, to the search, is basically that today the world is more complex than ever. So I'm a huge believer that the agencies do have a role. Depending on your campaign, what your goals are, you may choose different parts of advertising in different places. And I think print has a place. I think digital has a place. I think mobile advertising has a place. There's a huge now rise in mobile. Mobile is actually the extreme performer in 2016 and 17. Or is it mobile takes all? No, it's not. It's part of the strategy. Sometimes you will need primetime television to launch a new car. Sometimes you may need to engage customers with a mobile experience with location services. And sometimes you will need print and advertorials in the right context for a special purpose. So I think the role of the agencies is to help clients navigate a world that is ever more complex.
Well, to all of our media buyers who are listening on this Saturday to The Stack, no need to maybe update your LinkedIn profile just yet. You're probably going to have a role for a while. I'm talking to Alex Wish of Bloomberg Intelligence. We're just going away for a very short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about all things in the world of media. Stay with us.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Blay. Also, my guest today, Alex Wish from Bloomberg Intelligence. Before we went away to the break, we were just talking very briefly, Alex, about, yes, the fact that media agencies will continue to have a role. I'm wondering about the role of not analysts like yourself, but maybe those who are working for the banks. It was interesting. There was a curious story that I saw. It was probably earlier in the summer, and it was talking about the Daily Mail and certainly how the Daily Mail has been performing. And on one side, a lot of money still coming into the newspaper, into the good old print piece. At the same time, we keep on hearing this story about, you know, depends on who you talk to. You know, it's the English speaking world's biggest news website, depending, of course, how you define news as well. And within all of this, there is still a lot of pressure from analysts that I was reading saying, you know, they still need to do more. The revenues are still not there in the way that that they believe. If I'm sitting in the boardroom of the Mail's parent company, you know, should I be worried? Should I be listening to what the analysts are saying, or just continuing to do what I do?
Well, what's happening at the Daily Mail is that they have managed quite successfully to migrate readers online, and then they've become a global brand. Now, that said, circulation revenues still play a role. The print advertising plays a huge role. And while we see a lot of growth in digital still less than what they generate between circulation and advertising in the traditional format. Now, that is likely to continue for the next couple of years for sure. While the Daily Mail online generates a huge amount of growth, we are still getting a bulk of revenues coming from the traditional format. And what's interesting is that the rate of deceleration in the traditional format is easing. The Daily Mail, for example, they put up a cover price increase in February. Volumes fell a little bit, and actually the revenue was almost flat at the June statement. So that was quite interesting to see that the decline is not terminal for newspaper publishers, and that there is an appeal and people will still buy the paper even with a price increase.
So do you think something is going to change? And maybe is it the analysts are going to get a little bit older or a little bit more mature? We've had this narrative now. We've been living it with this for 7 years, 8, 10 years. You know, this whole push to digital. But I liked how you said easing, and that maybe we start to have a more mature conversation that let's just lay off the newspapers, let's lay off print. This is something which is going to be there. We have to foster it because there is money there. And yeah, we'll look at digital as well, but the future is not going to be 100% digital.
It never will be. I think what's happening with the print business, you have to play the right balance between the cover price from free to something and then the volume that you would like to have. If you deliver something for free, the volume can be amazing. You just put up with the cost of it. But we've seen huge successes when you've had a publication going free. Time Out, for example, in the UK. You've seen that a publication that has gone from charging to being free has a huge penetration in the right audience. And you can sell that very well to advertisers. Mm. Similar vein, closer to home, Bloomberg Pursuits, the magazine from the Bloomberg terminal users. That magazine is distributed for free to the terminal owners or to the terminal users. What happens then is basically you have an audience that you know very well who you're going to reach, average household incomes that are in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you can reach them easily with a magazine. So there is a role for print in the right format and in the right group.
I was in Germany earlier in the week, which is still a very robust market. And it's quite interesting when you think about a lot of the moves that have happened in the world. And we often like to focus on the big players internationally sitting in New York or sitting in London, even particularly in the English speaking world. But then you look at the power of Bauer as a radio owner in the UK, as a massive publisher. You look at Gruner and Jahr throughout Europe. You look at even Springer launching, of course, two new magazines in the last little stretch, plus buying the likes of Business Insider last year as well. A lot of dynamism, and at the same time, a lot of editors and people who are in charge of print saying, okay, enough is enough now. We sit in our board meetings, we get beat up, we've been told to cut costs, and yet, ladies and gentlemen, look at the screen up there. Look who's bringing in the cash. We are. We the magazine publishers. And the digital contribution is still nothing. And I'm wondering if, do we reach the end of this year, Alex, as well? And maybe there is also a different moment of understanding or great moments of revelation, where companies are going to also say, it's not just the analyst's job, but it's also the proprietor's job as well to say, it's not even just a question of spreading my risk, but I need to look more confident in certain areas because I've been banging on about this digital thing for so long.
Well, that's right. But the other thing that the print brings to the equation is not just the revenues that you get from circulation or from the print advertising. You also have a brand. And that's something that I think we've spoken about this before on other occasions, is the idea that successful brands generate an ecosystem. So basically, some of these huge brands, what they do is make a lot of money from events. Now, if I create an event just by myself, no one's going to come to it. But unless I offer a lot of alcohol in between. But what happens is that if you have a global brand with a global reach and a global publication that you trust, the event is an instant success. That's something that the Daily Mail, for example, has done very well. And that's something that a lot of publishers are seeing, that the publication is a window to a lot of other services that you can provide, being selling things or doing events. Time Out has captured that. I mean, they become sort of a go-to service to go out in cool urban areas.
Absolutely.
And that provide a service to users in many ways that can be monetized. Mm.
Just before we go to talk about the titles that you brought along today, one of my favorite stories when I was in Germany was talking to Gruner & Jahr. They have a magazine called Beef, and Beef was created to be a food magazine, but also by extension, a lifestyle magazine for men who, of course, they like to get around a grill and they like to cook meat. But they were talking about the events they pull off, and they said, 2,000, well, men and women, 2,000 people, families, whatever, coming to a barbecue event, which they had to pay for, in the middle of Hamburg. And that is just extraordinary when you talk about the ecosystem and the draw of a powerful brand and that association that comes with it.
I was talking exactly about that kind of ecosystem. So if you're building a community around a certain purpose, and if you do that, I think people will buy the magazine and will engage in events that are associated to the magazine and to the events that are around it.
Just before we go, we've got a few minutes left. You touched on Bloomberg Pursuits, and you were comparing and contrasting a little bit to something else like the Evening Standard. But as you said, so Bloomberg Pursuits, I think we have one terminal in our building, so we do get a copy that comes in. And this is a very interesting magazine. I'm just looking. We've got Matt Damon on the cover, and I guess this very much ties in. Is it Matt Damon or is it not? Maybe it's got a glass.
Ewan McGregor.
Oh, no, it's Ewan McGregor. Sorry. I thought that was sort of belatedly Matt Damon promoting something. That was a bit earlier in the summer. Nevertheless, it's amazing, as you said, if you're a terminal user with Bloomberg, this arrives on your desk. And, you were saying that, obviously it's pretty guaranteed that to most people who have a Bloomberg terminal or terminals on their desk are making, six-figure, seven-figure salaries, which is a lovely thing. And of course, no surprise that you attract an extraordinary galaxy of advertisers, Patek Philippe on the outside back cover. We have Hermes and Chanel leading when you open up. Are you surprised that there aren't even... there aren't more titles out there like this? Or do you think, in a way, what you guys are doing is almost pointing a way for others who have a great product? And of course, custom publishing is nothing new, but to have this very, very defined audience, you probably need to be going down more of a route like this.
I think that the free circulation, and I quote free, there's nothing free, but...
I talked to our CFO about our Bloomberg subscription, absolutely not.
But basically, that you get something when you're buying something else. So the idea is with circulation that you can guarantee a certain reach to a certain user that's very hard to come by, because now we live in a very fragmented world, and ourselves, it's not just in the old days you would say I'm targeting men or women out of a certain age. Today you cannot say that anymore. So the idea of targeting a niche audience that's interested in finance in some locations with certain attributes, and that you can know who they are, and that is something that's very hard to get by and reach them when you want them.
Mm.
And as we ourselves become more interested in anything from scrolling views on a mobile phone to having an advert in the cinema, it's going to be very hard, and even harder and harder to reach us.
Mm.
So I think the role of free circulation, where you can define an audience, will become much, much more important.
Mm. You've also brought in a very familiar paper. You've got a copy of the FT there. I thought maybe you would have had something which wasn't so related to the daily chores of business. But it's just interesting going back to when you talk about sort of scrolling and all the things that you need to do, and anyone who spent time also in a Bloomberg newsroom, I mean, just knows that it is info overload in any environment, the amount of screens, tickers, all the things that are happening. But here you brought the second section of the pink paper, and I'm wondering what role that still fulfills for you.
Well, I I'm a bit boring in a way, because I'm a financial analyst and I need to read it. What I like about the Financial Times and the way it's evolving, it's also capturing some of the fan aspects on the FT Weekend, for example, on the magazine as well. So what you find there is that the paper itself, while fulfilling a role for financial analysts like myself, it also offers a bit of entertainment. And also in terms of style, if you look at it as well, it's adopted a scrolling view a long time ago already, and increasingly all the publications were more and more used to the scrolling view. You know, that's a huge trend that's been exacerbated by the mobile usage of scrolling news. So with that, I think that the FT basically tapped on that way of actually reading very early on, and I really like that.
Mm. And just before we go, is there also a component? It's not just the FT, it's of course many titles, but there is of course a difference in the English language world between how British newspapers report and how they inject opinion into news, which is very different from how the Wall Street Journal reports, and certainly how the New York Times might behave as well. Do you think that's also part of it too? You know, in an era when there's so much information out there, that there is a trust, they've made brands out of so many of their correspondents and columnists as well. So is there a value in that? And maybe bringing it back to the, let's say, the digital component, you know, that is also something which is part of an FT ecosystem, which is very different. It's an investment over time, a commitment to journalists that maybe, or journalism that we don't see elsewhere.
I think I wouldn't do the British-American divide. Some of our readers would get very upset with that.
I know, it's right.
But basically, the one thing that I would rescue from your comment is the fact that you need good commentators, you need good writers, you need good journalism. And I think, especially for publications that charge cover price, that don't rely 100% on advertising, and the FT is one of them. So I think for newspaper publishers, you have two choices. If you have a niche market, like the financial analysts or financial or people that work in finance, and you want to tap that world, you have to have very specialized content with very acute writers that do analysis and comment, and people that you would like to read. The other end of the spectrum is if you have a generalist newspaper, you cannot charge a lot for your cover, or you have to go free. And that's something that a lot of successful publications have also done. And I was highlighting, for example, the Time Out in magazines, but I could also highlight the Evening Standard in London being a free publication at the point of use. And that is two different strategies for newspaper owners. So it's a choice that they have to make where you would like to make your money. Some circulation or no circulation money, and how much you can charge for advertising depending on how accurate and how focused your audience is.
Well, for all of our journalism school listeners who are just heading off into their first year, there's two paths to follow. Alex Wish from Bloomberg Intelligence. Very good to see you. That's all the time we have for this week's show. Many thanks to our producers, Ben Rylan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And our editor has been Cassie Galpin. And Toby Hammond has been very ably manning the deck in the glass beyond. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. Remember, back at the very same time next Saturday, probably in this very same studio. And of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Tyler Brûlé. Until next time, goodbye.